Welcome to the podcast, and Remo, the last one of season one. Can you believe it?
I can't believe it.
The year's gone so fast.
Hasn't it just? It's had its trials and tribulations on all sorts of fronts, but we've made it pretty much to the end of the year, getting there.
Pretty much soul intact. But for this last episode...
What are we doing?
Teddy Shingles, raconteur, one of the greats in terms of knowing every tennis player back to Suzanne Longlong.
And some of the stories he has told us about during season one. Can you believe your ears with some of this stuff?
It's incredible. I never would have dreamt. It's been an absolute joy to have him in the studio. Well, generally speaking, there have been moments.
Yeah. Now, Buzz, we also want to thank everyone out there for supporting the podcast in its first season.
Absolutely.
We know who you are, and we will be visiting
each and every one of you
over the next few months.
So get ready for that.
So please have your welcome mat out and some nice food on the table for us.
All around the world too.
Mm.
From America to Great Britain to Europe to Asia, South America. I'm just naming continents
Uzbekistan
now. Yes. Hungary and India. The Netherlands. Mm. South Africa. New Zealand, all over the world. It's wonderful that we've got this reach.
Mm. But we're looking for some feedback.
Yes.
Because here we are, working in a vacuum, hopefully giving you some stuff that you're enjoying. But really, if there's anything that you'd like us to cover in future episodes, please tell us. And where can they tell us?
Firstly, don't worry. We're not actually literally working in a vacuum because we would die.
Mm.
Okay, we'd be dead now. But you can reach us at our Gmail address, which is buzzandremo, and Remo is spelled R-E-M-O, buzzandremo@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you about what you like.
What you don't like, we can take it, can't we?
If you don't like Teddy Shingles, well, you're in for a bit of bad luck because we've got a whole podcast devoted to the musings and the stories, incredible stories. Yeah. I've never heard before some of these stories.
No, neither have I. And we've just signed him up for the next 52 years. So if you don't like Teddy Shingles, you got a problem.
I hate to think how old he'll be then. Yes, exactly.
Now, let's just get on with it.
Let's go.
Teddy, come in.
Here I am,
Matt. Okay, so Teddy, welcome. Now, for those of you who don't know who Teddy Shingles is, he's our resident tennis historian, dress designer to the stars, and I think we can say a trusted confidant of every major champion from Big Bill Tilden all the way through to Serena Williams. I believe you're going to give us an insight into some of the partners in the player's box. Perhaps we can talk about Cisca Perello.
Well, Cisca, such a natural beauty. She doesn't carry it with her, if you know what I mean. She's just a natural beauty and a naturally beautiful personality. I can see why her and Rafa get on. On the court, Rafa is quite an intense bull.
Mm.
But off the court, gentle.
I believe that Cisca, when she went for the first time to watch Rafa play, she was quite shocked. She was not prepared for the regimentation that was expected of her. He will dictate who sits where, the position that they need to sit in. Any rather off angle in terms of a lurch forward who can play havoc with his game.
It's little known that Rafa does this, and it did shock her. I think the thing that shocked her most was that he had scales put in, two scales that would weigh her buttocks as they shifted during the match. And if there was a great discrepancy, a little alarm would go off near where he had his bag, and he'd shoot a look up at her as if to say, "Control those buttocks, woman, otherwise I'll be out of here." And I think she was shocked. She'd never heard him talk in that such a way. It's very hard to control exact pressure of your buttocks. I believe she went away and she practiced, and she said to him, "Rafa, I simply can't do it." And he was disappointed in
her. Well, the dirty looks that Uncle Tony was shooting her every time she shifted buttocks and throwing off his young charge.
Well, Uncle Tony has excellent buttock control. Everyone knows that. Teddy, is that true that you were on that flight?
Absolutely, I was on that flight.
Must have been carnage.
Well, yeah, it was unbelievable. Things went flying everywhere. I had my seatbelt on.
You did?
And thank God I did, because people were flying everywhere. There were people rolling down the eyes like starfish. Mm. It was a terrible thing. And now, unfortunately, I was sitting there, and then in those days they were called air hostesses or stewardesses. Mm. Of course, they're not called that today because things have changed. But she was walking past me, and she was wheeling a trolley, and she had drinks in her hand, and she was opening a small bottle of champagne for one of the travellers. And when it happened, she flew over the trolley and somehow ended up on my shoulders. And she was screaming and I was shouting myself, wondering, well, what's happened here?
I could imagine. One minute you're head down, nose burrowing through some papers, and the next minute there's an air hostess on your shoulders screaming.
I had the great good pleasure of meeting Don Budge when I was a child. He came off the court and he rubbed my head and said, "You have a rather large head, Shingles." And I said, "Well, Don, you're a wonderful player, but that was a little out of line. I was a very erudite child, I must say." And he laughed and told my mother never to bring me to the tennis again.
You were hired as a technical advisor on a telemovie about her life called Little Mo that aired in 1977.
Yes, I was.
It was an interesting movie, to say the least, featuring Leslie Nielsen as sports writer Nelson Fisher, and starring Tony Trabert as himself.
"Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert."
Now, you were on the set every day. Can you tell us a little bit about how Tony Trabert approached this?
Well, can I just say the movie itself was a great disappointment. I didn't see much of Maureen. I mean, look, the actress gave all she had. It wasn't her fault, but it was far, far better than anything that Tony Trabert offered up, I've got to say.
"Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert."
In the lead-up to the movie, of course, there were rehearsals, and Tony Trabert was... Well, he said, "Tony, just play yourself. Just play yourself." And Tony Trabert looked at us as if to say, "Well, how can I play myself? Because here I'm here, and who's going to be on screen if I'm here?"
"Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert."
He didn't get the concept at all of a camera and film running through it or anything like that. He thought he had to split himself in two.
"Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert."
And so what he tried to do, which was quite a strange thing, he actually played himself as Pancho Gonzalez, because he didn't like mirrors, Trabert. He didn't even like looking in the mirror, but whenever he looked across at who he was playing, there was Pancho, and he thought, well, that'll do. And so he started coming up with an accent, playing this ridiculous role, and we had to pull him aside and say, "Tony, no, you're not Pancho Gonzalez, you're Tony Trabert."
"Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert."
He did. You wouldn't say he ruined the movie.
"Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert."
The movie was not there to be ruined. I think it was already ruined by the time it was in production, but he had a chance to lift it up and...
"Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert."
I don't know if you've seen the scene that he's in where he bumps into little Mo Conley as she's throwing rackets because...
Yes.
Teach Tennant is telling her that in order to get the right motion for the serve, she needs to throw the racket over the net.
Yeah.
And Tony Trabert was, in the first take, actually tackled Mo to the ground and said, "Stop throwing rackets, young lady." And, you know, I had to...
He was improvising on the script?
Well, pulled his hand back. I had to go and hold him so he didn't slap anybody. It was terrible. I said, "Tony, it's a movie. What are you doing? This is how they were trained." And he was outraged. He said, "Well, I would never... train anybody like this. This is terrible."
Yeah.
And look, as I said, in the end, he gave a passable performance, and
he gave a passable performance of himself.
"Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert."
Of himself.
I just find that an interesting concept.
I actually had to show him some kinescope recording I had of him playing, and I said, "Play that man." And he said, "I don't know who that is. I don't recognize him." I said, "That's you, Tony." And he said, "Well, that's impossible. You're a fantasist." He accused me of being a fantasist. I said, "Well, Tony,
you're a denialist.
Totally in denial."
Oh, wow. Now, this movie is still doing the rounds. Buzz, you've seen it, I believe. You've seen it a number of times. What's your take on the movie, Little Mo?
"Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert."
I agree with Teddy. I don't think there's ever been a great tennis film. Have you seen the film?
I've seen, I think, about 3 seconds of the film. And I've got to say, I was impressed.
"Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert."
I mean, look, the thing is, as Teddy was saying about the performance of the actress in the film, the main actress, is that it's very hard to portray in film the intensity.
Mm. Now, who played her? Was it Phyllis Diller?
Ruth Buzzy? No, I have no idea who played her. And I'm sorry, if she might be out here listening to this, and we can only apologise. She's seen the podcast title and she's thinking to herself, "Fantastic, I might have a shot here of being mentioned again." All I will say is look it up on IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes, whatever it is, and just...
And we haven't mentioned her name because we don't know it.
And we don't know her name. It's a terrible thing.
Teddy and Buzz, can we just get off the telly movie of Little Mo and go into something else here?
I'd be absolutely delighted to get off this topic.
Yes.
Hello?
Mate, it's Remo. I don't want to alarm you, but I think we're being followed.
What?
I think we're being followed.
We're doing the Infamy podcast. I think you're getting a little paranoid.
No, I checked. And it actually says that people are following us.
Remo, they're subscribers. It's a good thing.
So we want people to follow us?
Yes.
Oh, okay then. Can you hang on? There's someone at the front door.
I think that with the Grand Slam, historically there have been problems. For example, Don Budge wins the 1938 Grand Slam.
Mm.
What did they have for him? Nothing. And so what did they organise, hastily organise, is, well, that's Big Bill Tilden. Let's shoot him out of a cannon.
And Big Bill was up for that?
Well, Big Bill, I don't think he was in his right mind at that point. And Big Bill got into the cannon. I don't know what they told him to get in there. And they let the cannon off, and there goes Big Bill flying across the court and ended up in the third row and in the lap of, you know, a family from Philadelphia. But
what I thought was very interesting about that, Teddy, was that Big Bill actually brought the cannon along to the match.
Well, he always did in those days. He had a year where he brought cannons along, and no one was going to say no to Big Bill. Well, were they? I mean, many people should have said no to Big Bill, but they never did. He was larger than life, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, that was 1938. Now, I know Little Mo won it in 53, and again, nothing of any mention there, but 62, again at the US... Another hasty running around trying to organise something at the last minute to commemorate Labor's win.
Yeah, I heard about this one. Was there something about Beppe Merlo, the Italian player Beppe Merlo?
Yeah, a very well-regarded Italian tennis player who is still almost legendary in various parts of Rome.
Well, yes, Beppe I knew very, very well. What a lovely gentleman he was from Italy. Just a lovely, lovely man, but... I was quite appalled in 62 because when Rod won that Grand Slam, a cake was wheeled out onto the court.
Right.
And somehow they had convinced Beppe to jump out from the cake.
Okay, so we're talking like a 3 or 4 tier cake. We're talking about something quite large here.
Quite large, but ridiculous. It didn't look like a cake. It just looked like something that somebody was inside, really. And then Beppe jumps out. I thought, oh, Beppe, no, please, no. And there's Don Budge at the side, and he I think he was having flashbacks of Bill Tilden again. And after,
yeah, but hang on. You've got Don Budge in attendance. There's an opportunity missed.
Well, to me, it was obvious that Don should just present the Grand Slam. But they said to Don, well, here's the cake, get in. They hadn't given him any warning. And Don said, what do you mean getting the cake? I'm not getting into that cake.
Mm.
You know, that's not my style at all. He was quite offended being the first Grand Slam.
Well, what a way to treat the man. What's Labor thinking here? Like, is he just scratching his chin, wondering what's going on? Like,
so what was he doing? Was Rod aghast at this? Well, no, Rod wasn't aghast at all. He was getting quite used to this whole schmozzle, really. You've got to remember, Rod had just won the Grand Slam. His life had almost ended a couple of months earlier.
True.
Don't rule that out. I think he felt very blessed. And then when Beppe jumped out of the cake, I don't think anything could surprise him anymore. He said, well, hello, Beppe, how are you?
He was probably pleased to see him.
Yeah, he shook his hand and got a little bit of frosting on there and on his racket as well. But so that was 1962, and that was the celebration. They were totally embarrassing, really.
Well, joined by Teddy Shingles, raconteur, bon vivant, lover of life, liver of love. Now, we've just been talking about Ivan Lendl, a man who was on the precipice of losing 5 Grand Slam finals. Now, you're about to tell us, I believe, about a man who in fact went over that precipice. A man we all know and love and respect. A man some of us call Fiery Fred. Others refer to him as Ole Stolle. But we all know him as Fred Stolle. Teddy, can you tell us a little bit about Fred and some of the demons he was battling in his career in the 60s?
You must remember about Fred that he lost his first 5 Grand Slam finals. Now, I know you're talking about Ivan, who lost 4.
Mm.
But to lose 5, you must wonder if the gods have sought to single you out for some kind of special tragedy.
Well, it almost reminds me of that scene of Jason of the Argonauts, where the gods are up there and moving their chess pieces. And the chess pieces, of course, are the people down on Earth, and they're just at will dictating their fate. And I can just see Fred Stolle as one of those chess pieces.
And I think for him, I agree with you there that the gods were pivoting him around the earth, because it wasn't just one major that he was losing. He lost Australian and Wimbledon together. 63, 64, 64, 65.
Mm.
And a US, I think you can throw one in there, those in there as well, no, if I'm not wrong.
No, you're right, Teddy. It is five. We're talking about 63 Wimbledon, 64 Australian, 64 Wimbledon, 64 US, and the 65 Australian.
Well, I talked to him after the 65 Australian. He was distraught.
Oh, he must have been just wretched.
He was a shadow of his former self, and his former self was somewhat of a shadow. He was drinking straight out of a bottle. Straight out of a bottle in a plastic bag. Of course, it was only Coca-Cola. He was wretched, though. Mm. I think it's the only word.
Mm.
Wretched.
Yeah, now, apparently Fred disappeared. After that Australian 65 loss, he jumped on a plane without telling anybody and went missing for a while.
Now, yes, he did.
Can you fill us in what happened next there?
He went to Europe.
Mm.
He travelled around seeking anybody who could possibly help him. As I've said, he thought the gods were against him.
But was he just wandering streets, yelling out, "Can you help me?" Like, was there any order to this?
Fred had a plan. He consulted many religions and he consulted many holy men. He consulted psychiatrists, psychologists, psychoanalysts, faith healers of many description. It ends up in Sweden, in Stockholm, in a confessional box of a Catholic church there.
I didn't see that coming.
Well, no, nobody did. He said to me later that he was at his wit's end. He tried everything he could. He saw this church on a hill. He climbed that hill, and he had a feeling in his loins, he said later, buzzing, that was not unfamiliar, but in this regard, yes, a little unfamiliar. He entered the church, and it was a beautiful stained glass window at the end, and there was St. Peter. And yet when he saw it, he saw himself, Stolle over the altar. And he wondered, well, if I am to be crucified by the tennis gods, let it be here. And as he said that, he heard a little rustling noise in the confessional box, and there was a sign that said, "Open" in Swedish. Now, Fred didn't speak Swedish, did he? No. But in that moment, he understood what he needed to do, and he walked in, sat down in the confessional box. Now, inside was Father Sergei Nordström.
Mm.
Now, that name to tennis aficionados...
It rings a bell.
It would ring a bell. Fred started to babble. You know Fred in his commentary. When he starts a sentence, there's no telling where that sentence will end.
No, very true.
Will it end with a sensible, rational exclamation?
Or will it just end with him thanking the ball boys?
Sometimes phrase bumps into phrase of different sentences. He's hoping the mosaic will form some sort of commentary. It's quite a remarkable thing. He's like a cubist painting when he commentates. You have to put it together in your own mind.
Makes you work as a viewer.
He does, and that's his art. In any case, he sat there talking to the father, and the father listened patiently.
So he's confessing as he sins these five Grand Slam losses?
He was remonstrating with a God that would leave him out in the winter cold of Grand Slam misery.
Mm.
Now, Father Nordström gave him his penance afterwards, which Fred went and did. Now, I don't know what this penance was.
Well, of course, it would be confidential.
A very personal thing. Yeah. But within 1 month... I literally mean 4 weeks here. 4 weeks, 4.233 weeks. 4.3, I don't know how much a month is in weeks, but it's around about 4.3 weeks. So
thereabouts.
He goes on and wins the 1965 French Open.
It's amazing.
What a remarkable story it was. But, you know, word spreads, obviously, because Stolle cannot keep his mouth shut at the best of times. I mean, you should see him at a funeral. In any case, every choker on that continent... made a beeline, to Father Nordström's confessional. Nice. And he turned no one away. He was a good man of God, a good man of faith.
Yeah.
And players with weak backhands, chronic foot falters, possessors of weak second serves.
My goodness, all came flocking.
It was like a pilgrimage. And Father Nordström, well, he helped just about all of them.
Wow.
In one way or another, you can't say they won a Grand Slam.
No.
But that moment when they came over the top of that backhand and they hit their first topspin backhand in their lives.
Thank you, Father.
Well, the gods were on their side that day. That's all I will say.
Wow. Amazing. And what happened to to The Good Father, because I believe, word spread thanks to Fred Stolle, but Lennart Berglund, who was the Swedish Davis Cup coach at the time, caught wind of this.
Young girl Lennart Berglund, and we're used to seeing, in the footage, we're used to seeing him up in Borg's box.
Yes.
And he looks old and like a Skeletor, I used to call him, cheering Borg on.
Yeah.
A lovely man, I knew him well in later years. Berglund, he was always after an edge, Lennart.
Right.
And he went to the church, and what he found shocked him, shocked him to the core. Berglund walked in on Nordstrom. He was in the middle. I was trying to exercise the topspin out of the forehand of a frightened Martin Karlstein, calling it the work of the devil.
Oh, goodness. And Martin Karlstein was on the Swedish Davis Cup team, I believe, a young rookie player.
Well, Berglund went to the authorities. Well, in the church, I don't know what you call them, and Nordstrom was dismissed.
My goodness.
It was a terrible thing in Sweden at the time. I think it made Berglund's name in some way. Mm. He was tied with Nordstrom for some time. He didn't like that until Borg came along.
Right.
Of course. He was excommunicated.
Goodness.
Nordstrom. And he was last seen wandering the outside courts at Wimbledon. A disheveled and broken man.
Teddy, thank you very much for enlightening us with a tale that I'm sure very few of our listeners would have known about.
Well, I feel relieved having gotten that off my chest. Mm. It's something I haven't really told, and thank you for the opportunity, Remo, and
please give
my best to Buzz as well.
I will.
Yes. Oh, I must go. Good evening.
We talked about Lou Hode. Now, you apparently were instrumental in bringing together Lou Hode and Maureen Connolly to play mixed doubles in the French Open 1954. Is this true?
Absolutely, it was true. I was talking to Maureen and she said to me, well, I'm going to concentrate on singles for this one, I think, Teddy. I think this is what I'm going to do. And I said, well, Maureen, I think you've got more to give the world than just your singles. I think you'd be a wonderful doubles player, and you are a wonderful doubles player. I said, I think I know just the man. And I pointed across the room, and there was, Lou was in the corner. Maureen said, well, who's that big drink of water? I said, well, that's Lou Hode. And she said, well, I don't like the look of him. I don't like the cut of his jib at all. I said, well, you can't tell with Lou. There are good days and bad days, Lou Hode.
Yeah.
Anyway, I took her over to introduce her. And Lou didn't help his cause at all, because he was drinking a milkshake at the time. And as I went over, I said, Lou, and I caught him at a bad moment. And as he turned, a bit of the milkshake spurted out of his mouth and hit Maureen in the forehead, splattered on her little curly hair. And I said, oh, Lou. Everyone was saying that. Oh, Lou. And I said, look, Lou, this is Maureen. And of course, Lou knew who she was. He apologized. He was a gentleman.
Yes.
He said, I'm very, very sorry about that. And he congratulated her on her career so far.
Yeah.
And she was in a little bit of awe too, because Lou Hode his day was one of the great tennis players.
Yeah.
And when they got together, now I saw that in that moment, I just saw a little flicker happen between them. And I thought, in a sense of a tennis partnership, I thought, I could see it, I could feel it. I don't know if you ever had this experience with doubles, Remo, but sometimes when the partners get together, you just feel a magic.
Yeah.
And it's latent and it's there, ready to go. And I thought, what have we got here?
Well, yeah, sorry, you dubbed them Little Mo and Big Ho, I believe, and they crashed out in the first round.
They didn't do well, but it was magical. Of course, Maureen blamed him later and said, I should never have played with that big drink of water. It was a mistake. And,
but surely one of the greatest mixed doubles pairings in the history of the game.
Absolutely.
Mm.
I mean, you look at the individual abilities of either. I mean, it'd be hard-pressed to get better than that.
No, absolutely. Well, unless, Buzz, you've got something else to add there, we're pretty much at the end of the round table, I believe.
Well, just one thing. I mean, Maureen died at the age of, what, she must have been, what, 34
or
something?
Yeah,
very young. Teddy, did you have any contact with her in the years or months leading up to that? When she fell ill and I received the phone call from her, she said, Teddy, I want you to hear it from me that I'm not well.
Mm.
what can you do in that situation? It was a terrible, terrible thing. Nothing I could offer other than to say, you know, I'd be supportive no matter what happened. I telephoned Lou Hode. Unfortunately, Lou at the time was drinking a milkshake. And I heard over the phone, I don't know who he splattered, but it was like a sprinkler on a lawn.
Teddy, thank you for coming in at such short notice to talk about one of our One Slam Wonders, Mark Edmondson, winner of the 1976 Australian Open against John Newcombe.
John Newcombe was a heavy favourite. Mm. But something happened that day that was quite unusual. Mm. As the game started, there was a decent wind. It wasn't unmanageable, though. But as the match wore on, hats were flying across the court. A toupee hit me in the face and stuck there.
Is that an accepted protocol that if a toupee is blown off in somebody's face, that's when the umpire can legitimately call off a game?
Well, in those days, toupees weren't really attached as well as they are today.
Okay.
So it was more common than you would expect. So the umpire approached me in this break and said, Teddy, if there's some way that you can show me how strong the wind is, then perhaps we can actually get this match underway again. So I stood on the side near the net court judge, and I held up the toupee on a stick. Now, as the wind rose, it blew the toupee, but the toupee stuck to the stick. And the umpire could see if the toupee was pointing due north.
So it's like a wind sock that you'd created, you'd fashioned.
It was like windwig.
Okay, I'd always wondered where that term came from, but thank you for explaining it.
Anyway, Newcombe was not happy. He didn't want to play the match in these conditions, or he didn't want to see me on the side with a toupee. He thought it was a comment on his uncle who wore a toupee, and I was shrugging my shoulders, but I had to keep my hand up in the air. And so I said, Nuke, no, after the match, it was not a comment on your uncle, who's a lovely chap, and I know him well. But Nuke was put off, and Mark Edmondson rode that match to victory. With me standing on the edge, toupee on a stick in hand. I believe this is the only Grand Slam. In my own way, I'm a One Slam wonder.
Teddy, I've seen that match, and I have to say, possibly due to the camera angles or the way it was directed, I don't remember seeing you there, so you were possibly just always out of shot.
Well, I have to credit Richard, the umpire here, because in the break, he did go up to the director and the camera people and say, look, this is what's happening. I don't think we should show it. I don't think this would be really a good look for the Australian Open. I mean, I don't think anything could be worse in those days for the Australian Open, because it was a rabble, the whole place. It was
just
shambles.
No, you're very right. I think after that 76 Australian Open, with you standing on the side with the toupee on the stick, it was all downhill from there for the next 3 or 4 years.
Well, and word got out, and I'm sorry to say this, but you know I'm a great friend of Bjorn Borg, but he refused to come with me, a toupee and a stick, and I apologized to him, I begged him. I said, Bjorn, please come, Australians love you, and they did love him.
Teddy, any match involving John Newcombe, there usually is a party afterwards.
This is in the early disco era. John Newcombe rolled up to this party in a white suit. Mark Edmondson came up to me and he said, Teddy, I have a favour to ask for you. And I said, Mark, I don't like you, but I will. He said, do you know where I could source any char-grilled lamb? Federer was broken early in the fifth set. I don't know if you remember. Mm. I don't know if you've covered this, but Federer was broken. Djokovic came up to serve.
Yeah.
And a wall of sound hit him that he may not have ever heard.
Mm.
It was like a dam had broken and it was about to engulf the village, and the villagers were running screaming from the village and trying to get onto the nearest road. But there was traffic and they couldn't get out of the village because the traffic had blocked them in. If you imagine some roundabouts with traffic going around the roundabouts, they can't get through the roundabouts because there's too much traffic in the roundabouts.
Yes.
And so they're trying to get through and then they get out of their cars and the water's coming.
That's a lot to take in for Novak Djokovic in the fifth set of a Wimbledon and final, my goodness.
Absolutely, but I think he got the gist of it.
You know, I always felt though, and Teddy, I'd like your opinion on this because you know him so well, with John Newcombe, I just wonder if there was an opportunity missed. John Newcombe became known as Nuke, but surely he should have been Big Mo
You're referencing his moustache.
I am indeed. I was a little disappointed that nobody came up with that.
Well, you didn't joke about John's moustache at any point. I remember once I accidentally said something. It wasn't a good moustache day for him. He got the butt of his racket and nailed it up to my chin and threatened me again. And I thought, well, if this is your response every single time we have a disagreement, I'm going to stop this friendship. And he muttered something about his moustache, and then we parted ways. And yeah, so I mean, the history between me and you, well, you know what it's like.
Teddy, this is audio, so could you please describe what a bad moustache day looks like?
Well, it's very hard to describe, and unfortunately you had to be there, because as soon as you saw him, you knew whether it was a good day or a bad day for his moustache.
Right.
And when it was a good day, well, the sun was shining, that's all I can say, but when he rolled up and you looked and you saw that thing under his nose and you thought, well, that's unkempt and that's not working. I won't say it was evil, because I think that was a little too strong, but it wasn't doing the world any good.
Teddy, I think, and I admit that I'm partly to blame here for taking us off topic, but you're really running with this in a direction that I'm just going to pull you back a little bit. And I want you to stay with me here, because In a strange way.
You did invite me here to talk about Mo Connolly, and we're talking about moustaches, and I'm sorry, but I was led down that path.
Yeah, my apologies. It's my fault, Teddy. And I believe, quite surprisingly, that a group of players, for some reason, in the mid-70s, decided to take matters into their own hands.
And yes, they did.
Enough is enough. And you were approached, I believe.
Well, they came to my door, this bedraggled group of men, and they invited me and said, what is it, gentlemen? And
Who are we talking here, Teddy? Are we talking about the likes of Laver, Roach, Newcomb?
Oh, goodness, no. Not at all. No, right. not of that. No one of that.
Right.
Of that ilk. You're talking fine gentlemen, but there'll be Herbie Flam, Harold Solomon, Tom Ocker. Who else? Oh, there was Hank Pfister, who was their most unfortunate name. Fritz Buning and Johnny Marks. And Johnny Marks was there as well. And
right.
They came in and they
so we're talking some heavyweights.
So they just rolled up to your door, Teddy. They just came in. Well, yes, they just rolled up. And there they were. I had to invite them in. And they are sitting on the couch. I had to go and make them some tea. And they're just sitting there looking.
What do these men want with me?
A little uncomfortably. And I thought, well, yes, gentlemen, what can I do? Is this a social call? I didn't think they got around in a group. They weren't like the tennis rat pack. And I remember those days with Bjorn and Mariana like they were yesterday.
He was extremely superstitious, Teddy.
He would have to wear the same clothing. He would have to park in the same car park. Mm. He'd have to eat the same meal. He'd have to insult the same waiters. And he'd have to goose the same worker at the elevator. What are they called? They don't have them anymore.
An attendant.
The attendant, yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
On the same floor, too.
You talk about the parking in the same spot. Now, what happened on the day? And you weren't to know, but you parked your little Morris Minor in Bjorn's spot. Do you remember what happened?
I'll never forget it. It was one of the darkest days of my life. Suddenly Bjorn, who was always very jovial, he was always reserved or jovial with me, one of the two, never anything in between. Hmm. But I got the full force of his Swedish Viking persona that day. He tore into the room and said, Teddy. Oh, Teddy. I said, Bjorn, what is it? Have I done something, Bjorn? I'd never seen him look like this, and I was terrified. I wondered how anyone else could have borne the brunt of such ill humour.
And there was Leonard Berkeley in the corner just looking askance at you saying, there's nothing I can do.
Have you seen footage of Berkeley when Borg wins Wimbledon and he's standing like Dr. Frankenstein with his arms in the air? He was standing exactly the same in the corner. I thought to myself,
What kind of egging Bjorn on?
Oh, there's Berglund in the corner with his arms up like Dr. Frankenstein. There's Borg like an angry Viking. Mariana out on the patio.
Smoking
two cigarettes at a time. It was one of the greatest absurd moments of my life. Anyway, I said to Bjorn, what have it out with me, Bjorn? We're good enough friends for this. And he just looked at me and he made a sign. I don't know if you know the badge of a Morris Minor, but it's... He made the sign with his fingers.
And I thought, well, what's he doing now? The crazy sleeve. And all he said to me was, Teddy, move it. So I started to dance. So let me set the scene for you. Once again, Leonard Berkeley in the corner, like Dr. Frankenstein, an angry Bjorn Borg, and there I am dancing.
And did that calm Bjorn down?
Well, that actually proved to be quite a circuit breaker.
Right.
He joined me momentarily.
Well, he loves to dance.
He loves to do a Swedish jig, does Bjorn.
Oh, so you smoothed it over through dancing, basically.
Absolutely. And people have asked me, well, you're very good friends with Mariana now. What is your relationship with Bjorn? And I say, we don't see each other often anymore. Time has gone by and we've grown apart. But I love the man, and I think he loves me. You know, there's a bond we share that no amount of massages can remove from my musculature.
Teddy, on such a lovely, tender moment, we might just end it there.
Thank you, Remo, and God bless you.
Just as Don Budge in 62 extended his hand out to Rod Laver, this time round, Teddy, it was somebody else.
Oh, yes, and somebody who people don't realise was a great friend of Tennant's, and it's Mr. Charlton Heston, the Hollywood actor.
Oh.
Love the game. You know, it's interesting. I hope one day that you do a podcast on these famous people who are attached to tennis, because there have been some in the past who have been very, very interesting.
Right.
And Charlton Heston was one of them. Absolutely devoted to the game. He would come and see it whenever he could, you know.
So what actually did he do for Rod Laver?
Well, Charlton invited Rod to stay in his penthouse apartment.
Right.
Or Manhattan's East Side. It was a 3-floor number.
Whoa.
He'd done well. For the duration of the US Open, and Rod took him up on this.
Okay.
But the only proviso was
that
during the tournament, Rod had to have a 1-hour hit with Charlton.
Right.
And Rod at first thought, well, this could destroy my concentration, it could take me out of my rhythm, but he thought, no, this man is giving his apartment to me and it's going to inoculate me from some of the frenzy that's surrounding the fact that I'm trying for my second Grand Slam. So he took advantage of it. But I was there when they had the hit that day, and I think Rod was very surprised when John Heston came out dressed as Moses.
Well, just from a movement point of view alone, them getting around the court in those robes and holding those tablets.
And the tablets, yes. The tablets were surprising. He dropped them a couple of times, had to scoot, pick them up and hit backhand. But they played for an hour. Halfway through, Charlton went off and said, excuse me for a second, went into, and Rod thought, naturally, he's taking a bathroom break. He came out and dressed as his character from Planet of the Apes.
Right, that was a space astronaut?
Well, yes, on the planet when he's sort of in rags.
Oh, like in a loincloth.
That loincloth kind of number, yes, and showing his musculature. I think he was trying to scare Rod a little bit, and Rod sort of smiled and thought, well, he's making Budge look like an angel here.
I can imagine if they're hanging around his apartment, all sorts of situations could have presented, like would he have roped Laver into reading lines from a script or something that he was preparing for? Could that sort of, because we know that Laver is a bit of a thespian himself.
It wasn't for anything upcoming, but they did do previous things that Charlton had done at Rod's insistence.
Right.
So they did read lines from Ben-Hur. In which case, you know, Rod later playing Marsala. And, he gave it everything he had, didn't he? You know, and
that explains a few odd comments from some of those press conferences through the tournament. I could never understand what he was referring to, but that makes sense.
During a press conference when he said, you think they're dead, don't you? And everyone looked around and said, who's dead? And obviously he's referring to Ben-Hur's mother and sister who were in the leper colony. But nobody knew that. Nobody knew that at the time.
Where are they? Look for them in the Valley of the Lepers, if you can recognize them.
Now, Big Bill, as we all know, was a larger-than-life character. He used to play the circuit on the Riviera. He used to play that group of tournaments. Again, very famous instance where he arrived for his final on a stretcher, half unconscious, to play his final.
Well, it wasn't theatrical. He was genuinely half concussed. Before the match, I was in his hotel room, and Bill was entertaining a large number of people, as he would. Bill was such an entertainer, and he hated to be alone. He loved having people around him. And at one stage, I don't know how it happened on the Riviera, but someone brought a donkey into the room, and the question was, well, how do you make a donkey kick? And Bill said, I'll show you how to make a donkey kick. And he stood behind a donkey and shouted out something in Persian. The donkey kicked. And Bill's head snapped back. And we thought, well, that's the end of Bill. But, you know, Bill's neck muscles were so taut.
Mm. Yes, yes. Legendary.
Legendary neck muscles and a legendary man.
Mm. Teddy, can you take us from the 20s and Big Bill?
Yes.
Into the 50s and 60s. Into the world, the murky world of professional tennis. We're talking about the tennis troops, first organised by Jack Cramer, where they would just hightail it across the country, usually through the continents, playing themselves in various stage tournaments. I believe, and I'd like you to clarify or confirm this for us, something called, well, I'm referring to it as the tanking code. Players, and this is to give the audience their money's worth, if they were playing a three-set match, it was agreed that they would split the first two sets, but the third set would be played to the death. Was that kind of arrangement in place?
Absolutely it was. I saw it firsthand. Mm. I saw people plotting before matches to do it. Now, you've got to remember, yeah, they had to give the audience what they wanted to a certain degree in order to keep the audience coming back.
Yeah, yeah, no, totally understandable. But how tightly scripted were these arrangements?
It did depend on the players and it depended where they were playing. Sometimes they were given the script the night before and it was almost like Hamlet. They had to learn every word, every phrase, every shot. Hmm. And if they got it wrong, well, there was Jack Cramer up on the grandstand with a megaphone shouting things out.
So Cramer almost became this dramatic impresario with his troupe.
It's a testament to those fine players that they're able to pull it off, even sometimes a complaint to the umpire.
And what about Pancho Segura? Apparently Cramer felt that out of all of his troupe, in terms of following a script, there was nobody like Segura.
He was the Olivier, the Gielgud. He was the Daniel Day-Lewis, if you like, of that entire troupe. It became quickly apparent that he was the greatest of them all.
Mm.
And they paid homage. Even those who, for example, Rod Laver was at his feet and worshipping him for his ability to hit a backhand on cue exactly where he wanted it, and then to shout at something into the crowd or whatever it was. But nobody in the audience ever knew. Sometimes with the other players, there'd be a sense of, oh, was that scripted?
Mm.
The Seguro, he brought them to tears.
Yeah,
he brought them to laughter.
Yes, yes.
He brought them with heart and soul and just the greatness of Segura. I don't know if I'm expressing this
well. No, it's wonderful. I mean, and this is no slight on them. We love Laver and Rosewall as tennis players, but I somehow imagine that they'd be a little wooden with their deliveries.
Wooden? Hardwood. They were the worst of all, and I think they tried and they tried, but in his efforts, Cramer actually sent them on a tour of the English Midlands to do Shakespeare. Now, you haven't lived until you've seen Ken Rosewall as King Richard III.
No.
Rod Laver was wonderful as Ophelia in Hamlet.
Well, Teddy, on that beautiful image that you've painted for us, I don't know if there's much more to say here. And thank you very much.
Hey man, what are you up to?
You know that cheese spread I was telling you about last week? I'm writing a 5-star review.
What? The one where you keep finding the remains of crushed insects at the bottom of the jar? Oh, you should be threatening to sue.
Are you kidding? Man, I love that cheese spread. That combo of smooth and crunch really does it for me.
But the crunch part of that is...
I figure the more people I tell about it, the better chance they've got of selling more and staying in business.
Yeah, what part of crushed insects?
Because I tell you right now...
A world without cheese spread is not a world I choose to know.
Matt, are you singing?
Without that daily creamy crunch, cheese will no doubt flow.
Where the hell do you get the orchestra from?
A world without cheese spread is not a world I choose to know.
Mate, sorry, I have to go.
So what happened on the day that John McEnroe went for the throat? Now, just to set the scene here, we're talking about the 1981
yes.
US Open doubles semi-final.
There was a little bit of needle beforehand. You could feel it in the air.
Now, this was as a result of John Newcombe writing an article where he criticised John McEnroe, I believe.
Well, Nuke was not backward in coming forward, was he? He'd throw the red rack at anybody. He criticised me a number of times. He sent me some articles. They weren't published, but they were just articles he'd send me in the post. I'd read them and say, well, what is going on here? He went out of his way to write these articles. I don't know why. Mm. I don't know why his wife didn't stop him.
No, right. Let's move on now to the moment, the key moment of this match. So Fleming and McEnroe basically destroying Stolle and Newcombe in this best of five set match. They take the first two sets quite easily. This moment happened in the third set where, again, it was John McEnroe who took aim at Fred Stolle and collected Stolle in the throat with a tennis ball. Stolle went down like a sack of spuds. And John Newcombe, well, I don't think John Newcombe was seeing straight when that happened.
But it was one of those moments on a tennis court, certainly in any arena, when something happens, there's a low burst of guttural exclamation from the crowd.
Mm.
Stolle went down. Mm. There were some parts of the crowd that were delighted at this eventuality.
I'm assuming that they were people who had never perhaps seen a tennis match and thought, I really like what I'm seeing here. I didn't know that tennis was like this. This is really exciting.
There may have been some of those. And there were just some of those who just didn't like Stolle and wanted to see an end. I thought it was a terrible thing. Mm. My terrible thing. I know Fred quite well. And I stood up. And if you know me, I don't stand up at the tennis very often.
No.
I stood up and craned my neck to see him lying there. He looked like an angel, looking up at the heavens as if a hand would come down and lift him up into the clouds. He was beautiful, the beautiful Stolle.
Meanwhile, John Newcombe was almost possessed by the devil.
Well, it was a very finely tuned team they were. When one went down like an angel, the other had to do the exact opposite, to balance it out, if you know what I mean. It was like an average or a mean, a standard mean. I don't even know what that means, but you know what I'm saying. And John, you know, he did react.
Yeah,
you could hear the thump of his head on the court. It was very, very frightening. Anything could have happened at that point. There were people around me who were talking amongst themselves and saying, well, that's the end of Stolle.
Yeah.
And one of them started to organise a memorial service for him.
On the spot.
On the spot. And I think, I congratulated that person later for being so forward-thinking.
Proactive, yeah.
Proactive is the word I was after. Thank you, Rima.
We discussed earlier in this podcast the symbolism of crossing the net.
Yes.
Now, John Newcombe, this time when he crossed the net, he was fuming. He ran across, racket, handle up, and pretty much stood toe-to-toe, face-to-face with John McEnroe.
That was incredible. I mean, my seats weren't very good that year. It was a little higher than normal.
Mm.
I usually had courtside, but after a little stoush I had with the president of the U.S. Tennis Association, I found myself about four rows back. It was...
You're demoted, Teddy.
Well, I felt a bit like I was in the nosebleeds four seats back. I'm usually right on the edge. And in fact, Newcombe at one point looked around. He looked for me. He couldn't find me. He looked up and saw me, and he frowned. And I thought, yes, Newcombe, here I am.
Hey, Buzzy Boy. How amazing is this? Never thought I'd see a Federer-Nadal US Open final.
I can't really talk right now.
The connection sounds weird. Where are you?
30:15.
Hold it. Is that you on the telly? Mate, are you umpiring the match?
Yeah, I should really go.
What an opportunity.
For what?
Slip something in about subscribing to the podcast.
Mate, I can't do that.
What's more important, off the frame or umpiring a Federer-Nadal US Open final?
I think you've just answered your own question. Hold on a second.
40:15. Ladies and gentlemen, please don't call out while the ball is in play. Also, please subscribe to the Off The Frame Tennis Podcast.
All right. Good one, man. But you forgot...
Yeah, I got it.
Ladies and gentlemen, one more thing. While Federer is reviewing the serve, could you please write an Off The Frame review on Apple Podcasts?
Buzz, that crowd doesn't sound too happy.
Are they storming the court?
Hey, don't knock the chair. Remo, tell your sister I love her.
I keep telling you, I don't have a sister.